Bhagavad-deva-sudevaya. Questions for the test. I mean, to some extent, don't tell the management. I just thought it would be more like reasonable, really, or humane, as we said at the beginning. So we told you the other day, whenever it was, yesterday or the day before, you have to know those verses that you're already aware of. Then the defects you need to know and some examples of them. The three methods of acquiring knowledge you have to know about. Then how Prabhupada explains completeness, which Veda the Ishapanishad is part of. You have to know about quotas in different ways. About quotas, just study the subject of quotas a bit. Then, well, you have to know about the different types of people who don't follow the Ishavasya system. But you have to know about them. Yeah, who they are. I say more who they are, what they're all about. Oh, in verses 4 and 5, it talks about Krishna's different contradictory qualities and abilities and so on. So you should know about that. Oh, the Mahabhagavat should understand at least like the basic ideas about the vision and consciousness of the Mahabhagavat. I'm just giving a few little hints about the questions. I hope you don't mind. The culture of knowledge, what we talked about yesterday, you should understand that. What's involved in that, the different components. Then we get into areas we haven't gone into yet. Four verses which we're going to read through tomorrow, you should understand that. In a sense, it's fairly simple. But the main characteristics, well, maybe we can just mention about that tomorrow. So that at least is things to do with what we've studied so far. And any of you who weren't writing down quickly, maybe if you bribe Mataji here, she'll let you listen to the tape, perhaps, or me. So today, 12, 13, and 14. So 12 is on page 62. Andam tamaha pravishanti.
Which was used probably five, and when some words were, some, the mantra is the same, but there's one word which was taken out and more word was
named. Yeah, that's sort of the idea, basically. That, in essence, they're the same. In essence, they're the same. Actually, what they're saying is not different from one another. In sequence, 9 is the same as 12, basically. There's really no difference, actually. In fact, while we're at it, why don't we just look at them? Well, there's 12. Those who are engaged in the worship of demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so to the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. So then that corresponds with 9. Those who engage in the culture of nescient activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. So it's very, very similar at least. Very, very similar. Two types of people who are both headed down into the darkest region, basically. And then 11, 13, well, 11, No, 10 rather, and 13 correspond with each other. 13, it is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and that another result is obtained by worshipping that which is not supreme. All this is heard from the undisturbed authorities who clearly explained it. And in Mantra 10, the wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge, and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. So it's the same idea. In fact, the mantras are actually the same. It's just that there are two words in each mantra which are changed. Otherwise, they're literally the same. And in this case, well, in Mantra 10, the idea was that knowledge and, or cultivating the process of knowledge and the process of nescience, that they're different results, if you follow either of them. And then 13, same idea. If you worship the supreme cause, you get one result. And if you worship that which is not supreme, you get another result. Same idea, really. That which is really truth, the absolute truth, and that which is not truth is certainly not the absolute truth. And 14 is telling us that we should understand the temporary material nature and the supreme personality of Godhead, and in this way we surpass, we transcend. And then 11 was saying the same thing, really, that if you learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge, then you can transcend birth and death. The Sanskrit is somewhat similar in those verses, but the message is the same. It really appears that in 12, 13, and 14, the speaker he's just giving more detail of what he's really getting at. Like in 11, the last verse we did yesterday, that we have to understand nescience and understand transcendence side by side. Well, what does that mean? It means, thank you, everyone mark them still. Who didn't mark themselves? Ravi Lochan is here, right? Yes. Okay, well, mighty present. You're Ravi Lochan now.
Lochan.
Are you Lochan? Who's Ravi Lochan then? Because there's someone. Oh, he didn't mark himself present today. Okay, he's marked himself present the other days. Okay, sorry. Diversion. Hare Krishna. Okay. So 11 is telling us to learn nescience and transcendental knowledge. But what is nescience? Nescience means, as Prabhupada explained actually in the purport yesterday, we have to understand what the material world is about and learn how to deal with it. And what is knowledge, transcendental knowledge? Well, it means the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's the same idea. So it appears, as we say in mantras 12, 13, and 14, the speaker is really going into more detail about the same subjects that he's referred to in a more general sense in 9, 10, and 11. So anyway, in 12, he's talking about demigod worshippers. Some people think that if you worship demigods, it's not as good as worshipping Krishna, but it's quite good. Of course, in a certain context, if one is actually following a bona fide process of elevation, those of you who are studying Bhagavad Gita, you would have heard of the concept of the yoga ladder. It's like the traditional Vedic system of elevating people who have longer lifetimes, among other things, longer lifetimes, I think, than what we have. And they don't have access to Lord Chaitanya either. So first of all, they're on the animal level, they're just gross materialists, just trying to enjoy in any way they can. And then they come up to the level of Karmakandiya, get the same enjoyment or even better enjoyment, but without the sinful reactions, by following the prescribed system of Karmakandiya. Then you get the enjoyment without the suffering. And then even beyond that, you can go to higher planets. And this brings in the dimension of the nature of the self being not temporary, like the nature of the body. So a person may start getting the idea of some spiritual phase or level of existence through Karmakandiya, actually. Not only can you enjoy more and without sinful reaction in this life, but you can have a next life which can be so much better. So in this way, the eternal nature of the soul is introduced, even on the level of Karmakandiya, when it's properly taught, not when it's improperly taught, like we see in Hinduism, generally, basically means just enjoy life, by the mercy of the demigods. And then from that point a person would realize that rather than just having a better next life, better next material life, why don't I go to the eternal kingdom where it's actually my place where I belong. Not just a better wrong place, like that. So then they take up karma yoga and gradually become more purified and then eventually come to the point of bhakti like this. This is the yoga ladder. And you go step by step from one rung to the other and eventually you step into the kingdom of God. This is the idea. Of course, Lord Chaitanya's process, and we need some special process, I don't think, like in my case, I know that if when I came to Krishna consciousness and I was really thinking, you know, I've got to do something about my life. If they told me, yes, well, first of all, we'll worship the demigods. And then, you know, I went through Karmakandiya and then Karma Yoga. I don't think I would have made it as far as I've supposedly made it so far. So we have a special element that is Lord Chaitanya's mercy. And Prabhupada said that like, whereas the yoga ladder means step by step by step, and then after some time, you finally come to the top. But Lord Chaitanya's process is like getting on an elevator, getting in a lift, that you get in on the ground floor, and you press the button, and you just stand there, and before you know, you're at the top. Or you're definitely going up by some mercy, not by your own ability. Like, if you go up, particularly a big building like the Empire State Building, something like that, and if you try walking up step by step, it will really be really quite something. We have in Johannesburg, South Africa, a 7-story building, and when the lift breaks down, it's really tough. It's really tough. I can't imagine 100 floors, step by step. But on the lift, by the mercy of the lift, so to speak, or the lift manufacturer, or ultimately Krishna, I guess, you find yourself at the top. So by Lord Chaitanya's mercy, even people like us who are really not qualified, we can become elevated. So if I was getting at the point that if Karmakandiya is applied properly, then it can help certain types of people in a certain context, and not so much today's context, but previous ages actually. It can help them gradually become elevated. Otherwise, to worship demigods, it's not like second best to Krishna consciousness. It's not that, you know, it's quite good, but not that as good, but not too bad. Actually, to worship demigods just for the sake of the demigods or just for the sake of material enjoyment as an end in itself is condemned. It's condemned, like by this verse here, that if you do that, you will go into the darkest region of ignorance. It's kind of, oh, Narottam Das Thakur, he sings, I would rather live in a cage full of wild animals, like tigers and real nasty wild animals, than live in a house with demigod worshippers. And demigod worship and Varnashram, or like the materialistic version of Varnashram, they're also very integrally related. And we mentioned some days ago what Lord Chaitanya said about Varnashram practiced independent of Krishna consciousness, just on the material level. Lord Chaitanya said the same thing, actually, as this verse is saying about the demigod worshippers. He said that people who follow Varnashram very nicely, but on the material level, what will happen to them? They'll go to hell. So it's pretty heavy. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna, when he talks about the demigod worshippers, he refers to them as alpamedasa, small intelligence. And the verse here says that the impersonalists are even worse. They're even worse. And in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that the demigod worshippers, they're alpamedasa, small intelligence, but the impersonalists, they are abuddhaya. Abuddhaya means no intelligence, even less than little. They actually have no brain, and you know, they're actually destroying themselves in the name of so-called advancement. So as it happens in Mantra 9, of course the ignorant people were talked about, and they're not really demigod worshippers or impersonalists. But if you remember, there were two types of people in the second category who were described. Those people who are cultivating knowledge, but in a mundane and misleading way, and it ends up being dangerous for them. As they say, give a man enough rope to hang himself. Is exactly that idea. If he had no rope, he couldn't hang himself. But you give him some rope, and you think, oh, I'm doing him a favor, I'm giving him some rope, he could do many things with it. But actually, he's just going to hang himself. So anyway, the two categories described there were the Veda Vada Rita, who are demigod worshippers, and the Maya Parita Jnana, who at least in that context, Srila Prabhupada described as being impersonalists, or people who are into this idea of, I am God, you are God, we're all God, anybody can be God, and you know, you can choose your own God, elect him, just appoint him yourself. You can be democratic about it, or autocratic about it, as you like. Yata mata tata pata, as many people, as many paths. And if it suits you, then that's all the qualification it needs to be accepted as valid, as long as it suits you. So these are the types of people being described in this verse, actually. It seems that they are the Veda Vada Rita and Maya Parita Jnana types. Anyway, whether they are exactly those types or some variations, they're certainly related, and they're all going to hell very happily. I mean, while they're en route, they're very happy. When they get there, they won't be so happy. Srila Prabhupada told a couple of stories about people who were not scared of going to hell. He told the story of one man in India where, at least in bygone days, drinking liquor was really looked down on. And you would, you know, liquor store was some little hole in the wall around the corner at the back where no one could see. and he would sneak there in the dark in disguise and buy some and zip off before anyone saw you. So in those days, Prabhupada said, there's one story that one man who was a liquor drinker, he was told, look, you shouldn't drink liquor. It's really not good. You really shouldn't do it. And the man was saying, well, why not? Why not? I like it. So the fellow who's chastising him said, because you'll go to hell. And the man, the drinker, thought for a minute and said, you mean if I drink, I'll go to hell? Yes, you'll go to hell. He said, well, my father used to drink. Well, he must have gone to hell. My mother used to drink. Well, she must have gone to hell. My brother drinks. Well, he'll go to hell too. My sister, my wife, and whoever else, they all drink. Well, they're all going to hell. So the fellow, the drinker says, well, I don't mind going to hell then. Because all my family and friends, everyone will be there, and it'll be fun. So, you know, we may have an optimistic view of these things, but when you get there, it's really not very nice at all. Another story Prabhupada told you was of the Welsh mine coal miners. The Christian preacher came to preach to them, and he was trying to arouse some concern. You know, we got to do something about ourselves and change our lives. So the way he did that, he was telling them, you'll go to hell if you don't become a Christian. So they, again, they asked, well, what is this hell? And the man said, the preacher said, oh, it's a very dark place, and it's hot, and like this, very dark and hot. And the man said, well, you know, our coal mines are like that, and we don't mind. We've been working them all our lives, and it's okay. It's no problem. So we don't mind going to hell. And then the preacher thought for a minute, and then he thought of a bright idea. He said, well, but in hell, they don't have newspapers. And the miner said, oh, really? Well, we don't want to go there then. Yeah. So these people go to hell. These different categories of people. Killers of the soul. They go to hell. Some worse than others, just like here it's saying, these people, the demigod worshippers, go to the darkest region, but even worse are the impersonalists. They're even worse. And the other verse 9, it said that people are just ignorant, they go to hell. But even worse are those who have so-called knowledge. So they have a very sad, very dim future ahead of them. Prabhupada in the purport points out on page 64 how we can come to real knowledge. I mean, I'm just acknowledging this because it's here. I think we all know very well that we can come. Prabhupada says it's about 10 lines down, maybe, that the demigods and great sages don't understand him properly. But Krishna's devotees who surrender unto him in unalloyed devotion, they can know that he is the absolute person and that everything emanates from him. So like we mentioned yesterday, Prabhupada was making the point that knowledge does not simply mean that you read a book or many books or you just become very conversant with a certain subject matter. And in Krishna consciousness, you know, it applies so clearly, so very clearly, that even a child can know Krishna in the sense of having strong faith and strong, complete, or at least strong acceptance of Krishna. And you tell them something about Krishna, like the cobbler, and they say, oh yes, very nice, that's very nice. They can assimilate it. But another person who's not a devotee, even they may have a big brain and even a PhD in this sort of subject matter, but they don't accept at all that Krishna's God. So it's not a question of the quantity of brain power. It's not. But it is a question of the quality of consciousness. And this is where this, what was being described yesterday, this culture of Krishna consciousness, rooted in Krishna consciousness as such, in surrendering to Krishna. This is where this is so essential. Let's see. Srila Prabhupada chastises these various pseudo-religionists very strongly towards the end of the purport, particularly right at the end of the purport in the last paragraph. He really smashes them. He says, these rogues are the most dangerous elements in human society. Because there's no religious government, they escape punishment by the law of the state. They cannot, however, escape the law of the Supreme, who's clearly declared in Bhagavad Gita that envious demons in the garb of religious propagandists shall be thrown into the darkest regions of hell. Shirsha Upanishad confirms that these pseudo-religionists are heading toward the most obnoxious place in the universe after the completion of their spiritual master business, which they conduct simply for sense gratification. So, then Mantra 13, the basic theme, of course, we discussed in regard to Mantra 10, that we should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead and not anything else. Not anything else, not even demigods. Because you attain different results. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes the same point. Yanti Deva Vritande. You go to him. So it's very specific. And Prabhupada goes to some lengths in the purport to explain how we have to follow parampara. Very, very important to follow parampara. Very strictly follow the disciplic succession. And Prabhupada does a very interesting thing. It's a kind of technical thing, but I just thought I'd point it out. That in establishing, in the purport here, Prabhupada is establishing that Krishna is that supreme cause of all causes who we're meant to focus on, as opposed to demigods or human beings or whatever. Krishna is that supreme cause of all causes. Starting on at the bottom of page 72, the way he does it is by referring to various of the Vedic literatures. But if we look at it, is everyone awake? If you're asleep, put your hand up. Okay, let's try and stay with it. I know it's a little on the philosophical side. But the way Prabhupada makes his presentation of how all the different Vedic literatures are establishing the same point is, he starts on page 72 by referring to the four Vedas. If you remember, on the first day, I think it was, we showed a little bit the structure of the Vedic literatures. It begins with the four Vedas, and including the Upanishads, and then you get the Itihasas, and then you get the Puranas, and finally Srimad Bhagavatam is the end of the Puranas, and it's sort of unique in and of itself also. So Prabhupada follows that system. First of all, on page 72 at the bottom there, six lines up from the bottom according to my Ishapanishad, Prabhupada begins by quoting Atharva Veda. Then over onto page 73, about a third of the way down, again he quotes the Atharva Veda. You see that? Then a few lines further down, more or less halfway down the page, he quotes Moksha Dharma, which is part of Mahabharata. That's the Itihasas, the next section. And then Varaha Purana. Now he's quoting Puranic evidence. So, you know, we might not have picked this up if we were not really, you know, at least a little Vedic literature as a structure. But it would appear that Prabhupada is doing it in such a systematic way with a view to people who are actually Vedic scholars and who are really into these things, recognizing and then being able to accept, yes, this is actually an authoritative presentation that Krishna is actually that supreme cause of all causes that the Ishapanishad is telling us we should focus on and understand. And then Prabhupada refers to Brahma Samhita a few lines further down. Brahma Samhita is kind of in a class of its own, really. But it's not, I mean, strictly speaking, it wouldn't be recognized as, well, it's certainly Vedic literature. But as we know, Lord Chaitanya found just one chapter of it. So it's there also. And then on page 74, Prabhupada refers to Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, Bhagavad Gita is part of Mahabharata. So in that sense, you could say, well, it's Itihasa. It should have been referred to before the Puranas. But it just happens to be in the context of Mahabharata. Actually, in terms of the subject matter, it is also part of the conclusion of the Vedas. Krishna is summing up the whole message of the Vedas in Bhagavad Gita. And Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, we know, is the ripened fruit right at the top of the tree of the Vedic literature. So in this way, Srila Prabhupada is very scientifically, in a Vedic sense, scientifically establishing authoritatively that it is actually Krishna who is being referred to here. It's interesting, at the bottom of page 76, Prabhupada makes the point, and those of you who have read through all the verses and looked at the Sanskrit, you would realize that this Ishapanishad, and its characteristic of the Upanishads generally, that it's an indirect presentation. The word Krishna, or Bhagavan, or Parameshwara, these words are not used. But Prabhupada is explaining in such a way so we can understand that the types of words which are used, even though they're more indirect, but actually they're indicating Krishna. So the Upanishads are indirectly drawing our attention to the primeval Lord, Sri Krishna. But Bhagavad Gita, which is the summary of all the Upanishads, directly points to Sri Krishna. By hearing about Krishna as he is in Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, one's mind is gradually cleansed of all contaminated things. Then Srila Prabhupada starts quoting, he quotes a couple of verses from the Bhagavatam about how the process is devotional service and how Krishna helps. So Krishna helps from within the heart. If we take to devotional service, we become purified, we understand, even if we're unqualified, to start off with, Karata, Munandra, Pulinda, Pulkasha, like this, these lower categories of human or sort of borderline human beings. Even they, yen ye chapapa yadapashraya shraya, shudyanti tasmai pravavishnave namaha. Even they, if they surrender to Krishna, they can go back to Godhead. So, of course, people have all sorts of funny ideas. Some people think you should worship man. You may have heard the saying, worship of man is worship of God. As you walk around Vrindavan, you'll see, if you can read Hindi, there's one sign saying, go seva, Ishvara seva. Worship of service to the cow is service to God. So that we can accept in Krishna consciousness. But worship of man is worship of God. This is one of those slogans that Srila Prabhupada and all of our acharyas just don't appreciate at all. And one time there's an interesting conversation in which Srila Prabhupada, one man is trying to push this point. Yes, worship of man is worship of God, and it's fine, it's great, it's wonderful actually. So we should all do it. And Prabhupada is trying to argue philosophically, but the man is just kind of sticking out his point. And then Srila Prabhupada says, all right, if worship of man is worship of God, then that means that worship of God must be worship of man. The man was a little stumped. And then Prabhupada asked, so what is easier? What is easier? You want something, you know, like an accessible type of process that people can do. So what is easier, to serve man or to serve God? And Prabhupada explained it. You try and serve man and please man. First of all, there's 5 billion of them, so it wouldn't be easy. And secondly, even if you serve them, even if you dedicate yourself to serving just one of them, let alone 5 billion of them, you won't be able to really please them. You won't be able to really please them. It's very, very hard. There's one interesting thing happened that in Calcutta some years ago, there was a conference about, I don't know what, but something, but one of the Rockefellers attended, who they are meant to be amongst the richest people in the world. And in the intermission one day, one communist youth came up to him and said, Mr. Rockefeller, you're so rich. Why don't you try and help humanity? Why don't you distribute your money amongst the poor and help them? And Mr. Rockefeller said, well, I'll think about it and meet me here tomorrow at this time and I'll tell you. So the next day they met. And Mr. Rockefeller said, yes, I agree with you. I'll do it. I'll divide my wealth amongst the poor, and I'll start with you. Here's your share. And he gave him 20 American cents. So even if you're such a big man, what can you do? But if you serve God, Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Patram Pushpam Palam Tvayam. Yome bhakti prayachati tadaham bhakti uparatam ashnami prayatatmanaha. That you just offer a leaf, a flower, fruit or water, just to say, can you give this to Hankari, just outside. Just one leaf. Not that you have to get a whole lot of them, but just one. And one fruit. Not a big, colorful basket, but even one. And one flower, and just a little water. Anyone can get those things. It doesn't exclude anyone. As long as it's offered in devotion, Krishna will be pleased. So much for service to man being service to God. If you really want to do something, then you just serve Krishna. And as we know, and in fact Prabhupada makes mention in the purport, that you water the root of the tree and all the various parts become satisfied in the right way. In the right way. It'll actually work. It's not some silly concoction like going around with a watering can or a, you know, something and pouring a few drops on each leaf, which, you know, other than being a very painstaking and difficult process, probably wouldn't work, actually. Probably wouldn't help the leaves and flowers. And then in Mantra 14, again making it clear, what does it mean that we should understand nescience and understand knowledge and truth? What does it mean? It means that we should understand the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men and animals, and we should understand Krishna. and his transcendental name, and all about him. Not all, but as much as we can. And if we understand that, then we'll certainly transcend, and at the end of this life, go back to Godhead. In the purport, Prabhupada is stressing what he's mentioned in the verse, the temporary nature of this material world. Even if you're a Brahma, it means you live 311,040,000,000,000 of our years. Even if you're a Brahma, it's temporary, and it's therefore it's insubstantial, and we're not interested. We're not interested at all. We're not even a little interested. You know the story of, I forget who it was exactly, but there was one sage who had a benediction that he would live for as long as he had hair on his head, and his hair would fall out at the rate of one hair per day of Brahma, which means he would outlive Brahma, I think. He would probably outlive Brahma. And he was just sitting out in the open meditating or doing his spiritual Krishna conscious thing. And he had some disciples, and they were concerned that he's sitting out and it's hot or it's cold or it's wet or whatever. So they said, can't we at least build you a little hut? A little hut you can just sit in. He said, no, don't worry about it. I'm only here temporarily. So, you know, just, it's not a big thing. Forget about it. So this is the point that Prabhupada is making here. As far as the material nature is concerned, and Krishna, we should serve Krishna because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if we serve him and remember him at the time of death, then we attain to his nature without any doubt, that eternal, transcendental nature. Prabhupada, in his, you know, when Prabhupada says something funny, he normally does it in a very clever way. He talks about on the last page, page 84 in my book, Prabhupada says that when you know the temporary material manifestation alone, you only know that, then you cannot save anything. You can't make anything permanent. From the course of nature, there's devastation at every moment. No one can be saved from these devastations by opening hospitals. You can't. I mean, in this sense, a real and substantial, eternal sense, you can't help people. It's all hopeless. When the material nature decides to devastate, then you may be a doctor yourself, but you won't be able to cure yourself. When the material nature is just sort of prodding at you a bit, which is what our lives mean, you know, the difficulties that come to us, just the material nature is just needling us a little, then we can go to a hospital or take a dispirin or take a little rest or something like that to feel better, so we can continue. But when the material nature decides, okay, we are going to devastate you, then your whole bottle of dispirin won't help. And all the chavan prush in the world, whatever, the biggest bank balance, it's just not going to help. That will be that. Prabhupada said about Gandhi. Gandhi was so extremely famous. Wherever he would go, he was complaining in his last days. He couldn't sleep, because people would come and stand outside where he was staying, and all night, they would have all night vigils chanting Mahatma Gandhi Ki Jai, the whole night, actually. And he couldn't sleep, and he was complaining of that. He was such a big man, it's just a very, very big man. But Prabhupada said that when his time came, then death came and threw him away. Didn't step back and say, oh, Mahatma Gandhi, gosh, we'll leave you because you're such a big man. No, it just came and threw him away. And that was that. Yeah, so when material nature decides to devastate. That is that. And even in the meantime, as it's sort of needling us and prodding and just giving us the odd little smash on the nose and shaking us up a bit, then an intelligent person, a devotee, knows that this is just a little bit, a little sign of what's really going to come. So therefore I shouldn't be absorbed in this materialistic way of life, but I should surrender to Krishna, and that will make my life complete and perfect. So any comments or questions, Madhaji?
In chapter 6, or matter 6, is talk about the achievement of the philosophy. So I was quite clear. See, this knowledge has already been there with the very
teachers. Yes.
Why wasn't it
the It was. It was. It's a standard part of Bhagavad Gita, for example. So, you know, you find in the commentary of Sridhar Swami, his commentaries, like on Srimad Bhagavatam, Sridhar Swami, he's pre-Lord Chaitanya. And he doesn't use the term Achintya Bheda Bhe Tattva, but the concept, the import of it, he explains and he acknowledges. So it's there. It was just that at the time of Lord Chaitanya, and it was actually particularly Jiva Goswami himself who gave, you could say, a label to it, and, you know, really took it and sort of put it there in public view and made like an issue of it. Yeah. But it's not that Lord Chaitanya invented it. And it's not that before Lord Chaitanya or Jiva Goswami that the devotees were not aware that this is, you know, such an important element in our philosophy and our understanding of reality. It appears to have not been stressed so much, no, or made an issue of. It wasn't. Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. And she is understood most clearly. I mean, at least she is definitely to be understood in one sense in terms of Achintya Bheda Bhe Tattva. Everything is. Everything from Srimati Radharani down to the last grain of dust in the material world.
And from the other reason,
you're
saying how it goes fast and steps. Yeah. You also use that as an example to show that actually we shouldn't do anything, that we should just hang there and by
the words mercy
to get there.
Yeah. Isn't
something like that.
Some fundamental
change
of
heart, you know?
Oh, yes, of course.
Otherwise, you're getting
a barbarian. Yeah, of course. No, I wasn't intending it, at least, to express the idea that we actually do nothing and then we just suddenly find there we are. No, but the thing is there's a great, like when you follow the yoga ladder, it's very systematic and formal and deliberate. So with Lord Chaitanya, the element of mercy is much, much greater. And we have to hang in there. I mean, it depends how you look at it. Some devotees, even very, like in ISKCON, very senior and relatively very advanced devotees, if you ask them how they're doing, they'll tell you, well, I'm hanging in there. You could say it depends on how you look at it. But, I mean, you could say you have to watch out you don't fall out of the elevator, something like that. Or get off at the wrong floor and, you know, think you've made it, but actually there's still a long way to go. You know, something like that. But yes, it's a fact. We have to certainly make some endeavor. But it's not like with the yoga ladder, where at least till one comes to the level of bhakti, it is actually sort of mechanical, systematic, you know, step A, step B, you know, you just follow a process like that. Yeah. When bhakti enters into the picture, then mercy starts coming in terms of the yoga ladder. But with Lord Chaitanya's movement, mercy is such an important factor. Such an important factor. Right. Well, that's a bit of a subject. The thing is, there are different types of impersonalists. Impersonalist is like the sort of umbrella term that there are different categories of. And there are two main categories. One is Mayavadis. They are a particular type, and as it happens now, I guess, or in more recent history, like the last few hundred years, the most prominent type of impersonalist. But there is another type, and they're called Brahmavadis. And they are different from Mayavadis in certain respects, although the idea is to merge with Brahman like that, and that it's all one. You know, in many respects, important respects, the concepts are the same. But there are also very important differences. Like the Brahmavad, the Mayavadis, Shankaracharya invented this term, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya. Brahman is truth and this world is false. So they are anti this world. It's false, we don't want it. Like that. Whereas the Brahmavadis, so therefore they take Krishna to be Maya and they don't really like Krishna. Yeah, they don't like Krishna. Particularly his form. You know, they may like Bhagavad Gita, but when you start talking about Krishna's form and personality and the claims Krishna makes about himself, they don't like that. The Mayavadis. But then the Brahmavadis, they're much less antagonistic. In fact, in the Bhagavatam, there are two very important examples of such Brahmavadis. Such impersonalists. There's Shukadev and the Four Kumars. Both of them were realized Brahmavadis. Shukadev Goswami, he was already Brahman realized. But his idea was, or the Brahmavadi idea is that everything is Brahman, even this world is Brahman. And Krishna is Brahman. So, you know, we like Brahman, and so when they hear about Krishna, they think, oh, that sounds nice. And that was what happened with the Four Kumars particularly. They heard about Lord Narayan, and they thought, oh, that sounds interesting. They didn't think, oh, Narayan sounds like Maya, just another aspect of Maya, which is what the Mayavadis would say. No, they thought, oh, sounds like an interesting aspect of Brahman. So they became devotees. Yeah. So those who don't have an antagonistic attitude towards Krishna, then they may become realized. And they may become devotees. They may become Brahman realized. And they may even become devotees. But those who are Mayavadis, then they are spoken about in, I think, what is it, 10.2.3? How does that verse go? What's that verse? Patanchida nadrita yushmat angrayaha. I forget how that verse goes, how it begins. But, yen yen ravindaksha bhavoktamaniya nina. Yen yen ravindaksha bhavoktamaniya Tvasta Bhavat Avashuddha Buddhaya Arura Pritrena Param Padam Tata Patantyada Nadrita Yushmadangraya. Because they have an unfavorable attitude towards your lotus feet, they fall down. This is referring to the Mayavadi types, who are actually antagonistic towards Krishna. So this is the idea. There's this distinction between the two. And the Brahmavadis, they may, because they're not antagonistic to Krishna, so they may realize Brahman. They may even become devotees, but the Mayavadis who don't like Krishna, they fall down. Yeah. So the Mayavadis do not merge in Brahman, actually. There's no real question of the Mayavadis as such merging in Brahman. Okay, we're coming into the last stretch. Tomorrow, if you could read 15, 16, 17, and 18, in my opinion, they're the nicest verses in the whole book. Very, very nice. And we'll finish off with that tomorrow.